All right, today is January the 6th, I guess, year 2001, and I'm in Sharpsburg, Georgia, visiting with Mike Fleming and Eddie Turner of Brushfire Bluegrass Band. And we're going to go through these images here, and I will identify those. And if you guys will have some comments about where the particular performances were taking place and anything that's interesting that went along with them, that'll be a nice recording for us. We're going to start out here with 1978, M. Fleming 002A.
You remember that, Eddie?
Oh, yeah. Peachtree City McIntosh Amphitheater.
That's right, a McIntosh Opry, and that was probably one of the early times that that we played that. They were getting that thing started the same year that we were starting the band, and they didn't pay anything, and we couldn't charge anything, so it was a perfect match. Every Saturday night all summer, we played, probably six or seven times over there. First year of Brushfire.
Okay.
I thought Eddie looked especially good in that picture.
Yeah, I think I was between hairdressers during that time.
Okay, guys. Okay, we're 1978, M. Fleming 004A.
Let me talk about that one a little bit. That was, as I recollect it, that was a second job that we did, understanding that Eddie and Joe had a bluegrass group before we put this one together. They'd been trying different combinations, so they'd done other stuff, but as Brushfire in this group, that was on the square, the courthouse in Newman.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I was trying to make a fashion statement there with that hat. I'm not really sure what I thought about it at the time, but...
What did you ever do with that hat?
I don't know. I want to know either.
That was Newnan's sesquicentennial celebration. And I don't think they knew what they were getting when they hired us, but...
I know that hat was appropriate for the occasion, I'm sure.
Must have been.
All right, this is 1980, Mike Fleming 02A.
I think that was our first band uniform, wasn't it?
It was the first official shirt.
And
where was that made?
Was that at the lumber yard? I remember that, I think.
That's what I remember. Grand opening of somebody's lumber yard on the edge of Newman. We rode saw horses and played bluegrass music.
Things we do for money.
Okay, this is 1981, M. Fleming 013, and looks to be a Delta, some kind of a Delta advertisement, or
this was the
menu?
This was the program for the in-flight music on all of the Delta jets for 1 month. Donnie Lee actually made a connection with a guy named John White, who arranged all the in-flight music, and convinced John that he needed to have a bluegrass program on there, and... He did. So not only did he do that, but he took our first album in Bullsboro's and put a couple of cuts on the in-flight music for all the Delta Airlines around the world for 1 month period of time. I think we had the Arab bounce of all the things he could have chosen.
That's right.
Okay, this is 1982, M. Fleming 005.
This was in Nashville at the old Ryman Auditorium. We took a band trip to Nashville, and we always wanted to sing on stage at the Opry, so heck, we went up, paid our dollar for the tour, just like everybody else going through there, and got up on stage like we were somebody and sang an a cappella song.
I think we sang everyone we knew, and the other tours set out in the stands out there, and they even brought out a microphone at one point.
Yeah, that's right.
And we sang everything, which wasn't that many. We sang them all.
True. 1982, Mike Fleming 03.
We were out looking for an official band photo to use for promotion, just driving around in Peachtree City, and somehow that big rock seemed like the place to do it, and actually turned out pretty good for a local band. I thought the photo turned out okay. We used it a long time.
Okay, 1983, M. Fleming, 008.
Well, every once in a while, we just kind of get the yearning to do something sort of wild and crazy. So a guy named Elwood P. Suggins was playing bass with us at the time, and he always dressed up in overalls and white shirt and Panama hat. And Joe thought it would be a really good idea if we just all kind of did that occasionally, and we'd come out and call ourselves Suggins Brothers, which is what we did at the time. It was a lot of fun. We got a lot of laughs, and it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, we did that several times. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, 1983, M. Fleming, 009.
Eddie, you start out. You knew Joe before I did.
Joe and I played an electrical group prior to Mike and I, Mike coming on with the band, actually before there was a brush fire.
Mm-hmm.
And he always wanted to form another bluegrass band. Joe had been in one prior to brush fire called Bullsboro. And we set out to find a guitar player and was asking around, and through a mutual friend, Donnie Lee, met Mike Fleming. And so Joe Partridge and myself and Mike were the three original members of Brushfire.
They had been through every guitar player in this county. That's how it got down to me. They'd been through every decent guitar player, and they'd last a show or two, and they'd make you mad and quit, I think. But Joe was the inspiration. He was our leader. Aggravating rascal, we loved him to death. And unfortunately, he lasted 13 years with the group before he passed away in 1990.
Nobody ever made you work harder on a song than Joe ever did.
Nope, he was an arranger and the greatest baritone singer in this part of the country.
And that's one of the comments that I've heard on numerous occasions, was that he was as good, if not the best, baritone singer in bluegrass music.
He was a natural.
And,
yes.
Very complimentary folks in this area as it relates to Joe Partridge. Now let's look at a few other things while we're looking at Joe here. Let's reminisce about some things. You were getting started in the late 70s, and you were doing some trios at that point, or duos and trios, right?
Yeah, well,
when you were
out
singing, and then you eventually went on to four part. Give me a little bit of an idea about how you started out putting maybe a couple of voices together, and then the three voices together, and then eventually the great harmonies that you're known for today.
Well, when I hooked up with them, it's like August, I guess, or September of 77. Of course, they'd already been singing together in the groups they had before that. But we started doing trios. We hardly ever did duets. I don't remember doing any duets, really, in the early years. We did three part from Jump Street, and we just didn't have, at that point, a really good fourth part, and three was, you know, traditional in bluegrass, so that worked out pretty well. What we tried to do is, as we went on through the years, was take whoever else was in the band and build on their strength, you know, whether it was instrumental, vocal, or whatever.
Yeah, I remember the first night we ever got together in my old mobile home. And from that first night, the harmony just sort of clicked. We knew that it was going to be something.
I think they knew. I'm not sure I knew, because this was my first experience, really, at that kind of thing. But it was, you know, we found out we could do it anyway. And then we really didn't get into quartets so much. Gary Sykes, the bass players would always try to sing bass, but we didn't really have a strong bass player till Suggins. A bass singer, until Suggins came into the group. And of course, his background and his interest was in gospel, not all gospel, but mostly in gospel. Uh-huh. And he knew a lot of that stuff, and he had a strong bass voice and was a strong personality, so we just naturally progressed into doing quartets. We were already doing a little acapella. Amazing Grace was the first acapella thing we did with Russell Owen or John Landers, one singing bass on it before Suggins, but that's where we really got into the quartets.
Remember when we tried to teach John to sing bass?
Yeah,
and,
I do.
Joe said, John, you're not really singing bass. And John said, I'm singing as low as I can.
he didn't quite understand the concept of harmony.
All right, this is an interesting photo. Mike, you and Eddie are sitting in an oversized rocking chair, it looks like. This is a 1984 M. Fleming 007.
Yeah, let me start off. We were excited. Country's Barbecue in Columbus was, they used a bluegrass band every Thursday, I'm sorry, every Friday and Saturday night. We got a call, for some reason unknown, the band that played in there every weekend, all of a sudden needed a weekend off, and they pulled all of their gear out and went away, and we went in there and played on Friday night. And then what happened from there? Eddie, tell them about it.
Well, we were doing it Friday and Saturday, so we didn't see any need to take down the entire sound system, pack everything up on Friday night, so we left it. And for some reason unknown, when we returned Saturday evening to play again, the place had burnt to the ground. Along with sound system and numerous other band property.
We lost a couple of boxes of albums. We lost the band rug and the band ashtray.
Oh, yes.
We had our own red carpet that we took to play on. And we went in there and looked, and you could find it all, but it was melted down. Fortunately, we had taken all of our instruments, including the bass, out with us. But it was just a total loss. The guy hadn't even called us to tell us that the place burned down until we drove back into the lot that Saturday afternoon to play again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're at 1985, Mike Fleming 04.
This was, I think, that same afternoon. We were just out looking for places to take, scenic places to take a decent band photo. And in Peachtree City, and it was Pastor Don Smith's cabin, and he is still my pastor, and he still lives in that cabin out on Ebenezer Road in Peachtree City, and he just turned his house over to us that afternoon, and we made several shots looking for a band photo.
1986 M. Fleming 001.
This was down at Kissimmee St. Cloud Bluegrass Festival in I think it was a rodeo arena we were playing in, and we were on the same show with Bill Monroe, Bluegrass Boys, and we were standing backstage, and somebody came running down off the stage and said, Bill wants you on stage, and I want you to come up and sing a song with him. And we had sort of rehearsed a little song with him out back on stage prior to his going on, and we all went up. We didn't know the words to the song, but that didn't stop us. We had a chance to sing on stage with Bill Monroe, and we took it.
Even Ted went up with us. Once we found out, Billy, apparently he'd asked for us, and we didn't know he was going to do that, so we were way the heck down there. So he was halfway through the song before we all stumbled up the steps, and, you know, all five of us, we were doing some god-awful eight-part of harmony or something. And but the song was Farther On. It was a song that Bill had written. I don't know that he ever recorded it. I never heard it anywhere else. But we got up and then really tried to do some harmony with him. And I'll never forget Blake Williams was playing banjo with him. And when we finished up, Blake turned to us and said, "That's some of the best humming I ever heard."
Okay, this is 1989 M. Fleming 33.
That was just our latest effort at an official band. We always like to have a nice, you know, promo shot. We thought that always from day one, and I guess Joe instilled that in us, that it was important to have a good promotional package, some information and a good-looking photo. And we that's the current band from in this year, 2001.
I think, as my students would say, my bad. 1986 M. Fleming 003.
Once again, a Brush Fire official band photo. This was the one we actually hired. We went to a professional photographer over in Jonesboro. A guy, and not that we're pretty or it's a great photo, but he was really good at what he did. And of course, we'd invested in those vests. Once again, we were doing the uniform thing and getting us a new promo shot every time personnel would change. And I guess this was the beginning maybe of the Jay Richardson era.
Okay, 1986 M. Fleming 035.
This was in Jacksonville, Florida. This was a festival put on by the North Florida Bluegrass Association. And this particular group here had Carol Haney playing fiddle with us. I remember that day, it was probably the hottest day that I remember, maybe 105 plus degrees.
It was terrible.
High humidity, just made for a miserable day, but we had fun anyway.
Yeah, that was one of the few shots. Carol only played with us. The only fiddler we ever carried was Carol Haney out of Calhoun, Tennessee. And
how long did he play with you all?
Probably two seasons.
2 years.
Yeah,
it was very good.
At the most, two seasons, and he fit in well. But the distance between here and Calhoun, Tennessee, was a problem. But once again, we thought we were big. We were traveling to Florida. We'd been invited all the way into another state to play bluegrass, so we were proud.
Okay, 1987, M. Fleming 012.
Obviously, that's Ricky Skaggs and his daughter. In the picture there, we were another one of our trips to Nashville. We had pretty regularly during that period would just go to Nashville to see somebody at the Station Inn or to visit an old friend, J.R. And I have no idea who was at the Station Inn this night, but we were all there. And somebody had a little disc camera, and Ricky Skaggs came out of the back room with his daughter headed to the front door. And in a matter of about 6 seconds total, we threw the camera at somebody, grabbed Skaggs, jumped into position, snapped the picture, and he was out the door. Of course, the other side of that is we're old friends and known him for years, and this was a reunion somewhere. But
a six-second reunion. 1987, Mike Fleming, 05.
Eddie, anything particular about that? That's the formal look.
Well, no, it was just another attempt at having a professional quality promotional picture. I think at that sitting, we did a casual shot and then a formal shot, just depending on what the show warranted, depending on which picture we sent. So
that's right, manipulation. We usually always do a casual and a little more formal and decide, depending on who we were sending it to, which one would go over the best.
1989, R.M. Fleming, 006. What can be said about this photo?
Some things just defy description. But in Carrie's early days with the group, he would carry around this big gym bag full of hats. And you never knew what he was going to pull out of that bag. And that's his Captain Marvel look. And between songs, he'd just dive down into what he called his bag of tricks and come out with his grandma's old peak turban or a gas mask or you never knew what. And somebody captured him that night at the Dillard's Music Park up at Rome. He's kind of a trickster.
Okay, 1989, M. Fleming, 33.
The Brush Fire official band photo, current band, in this year of 2001. Not knowing what the future will hold, but that's our formal look. I think Ron Hipp, well-known Atlanta banjo player and guitar player, took that in his basement studio. Pretty soon after Carrie and Red became full-fledged members of Brushfire, we went in and had that done.
Okay, 1990, M. Fleming, 011.
Well, this was just a casual shot of the current group. Like I said, we always carried usually two pictures, the casual shot and a formal shot. Just depending on what we were playing. We were playing a wedding or a Tupperware party, you know, which one we sent.
So. That's right. We wanted to work, so whatever we had to do to get it.
One of my favorite shots, 1990, M. Fleming, 012.
I guess I better talk about that one. I don't know if Eddie had too much. He may not even remember that, but this is when we were in France, the Pyrenees Folklore Festival, and it was hot as blue blazes. They were in the middle of a hot spell over there as well, and they don't know about air conditioning and ice and stuff. So we all wore our shorts and our T-shirts and would have worn less if we could have gotten away with it. But at any rate, that's our bus that stayed with us and the special edition cloggers for the whole time we were over there, our tour bus, and Eddie and Carrie had gone out and bought themselves official French berets, or something they wanted, and you know, who could resist that picture when the two of them hugged up there next to the bus with their berets on?
And what's the French word for beret?
Well, actually, the French word, the first thing we did when we got to France, Carrie got a dictionary and looked up dumpling, because he didn't know what to call Eddie when we were in France, and he finally figured out that the French word for dumpling was les bouillés. So the rest of the trip, that's what he called Eddie. So that's Carrie and his little bouillé.
Okay, 1990, M. Fleming 034.
Tell them about it.
This was the band on stage at the Pyrenees Folklore Festival in Oloron Sainte Marie, France. There was about, I guess, 25 or 30 groups representing traditional forms of dance and music that originated within each group's country. And we were there representing traditional American music, which is bluegrass music.
And this was one of the backdrop, the lights. This is a big deal. It's in the Pyrenees region. It's in on the France side one year and on the Spanish side the next. And it is really a big deal. And you can see the elaborate in this picture, the staging in the background, the lights and things. They had the Statue of Liberty and different, for every country, they had real elaborate things. And there is one additional brush fire. The only time that, when we started talking about this, Carrie was a little hesitant about going or wasn't sure he could go. So I recruited Bob Donaldson, who played guitar and banjo and dobro. I just asked him if he'd be interested, thinking in the event Carrie didn't go, that BD might be interested in going with us. And he latched onto it and didn't turn loose. So fortunately for all of us, Carrie was able to make the trip. And we took Bob Donaldson along to play dobro and kind of as a utility fielder. And he was a part of Brush Fire for about 3 weeks there.
1990, Mike Fleming 06. I believe we've already seen that.
We've already seen that. We know that's when we got in there twice, reversed.
1995, M. Fleming 014.
I'll start out. For me, that was, you know, kind of one of the highlights of the 23 years so far of Brush Fire. We were fortunate enough to be inducted into the Hall of Honor at the Atlanta Country Music Hall of Fame. And that's thanks to Johnny Carson, the grandson of Fiddlin' John Carson, and Phyllis Cole, the co-directors of the Atlanta Country Music Hall of Fame. And Dumplin', you will say something about that night?
It was quite an honor to get that award, to be inducted into the Hall of Honor. It's I know Johnny and Phyllis really put a lot of work into that organization, and
yeah,
it's great to have a local organization that can honor local area musicians and people.
And since then, just a couple of years later, they really got more interested in bluegrass community, and we inducted 21, I think, bluegrass pioneers into that Hall of Honor just a couple of years after this. This was 95 and maybe 98. So bluegrass is well represented in that Hall of Honor.
Okay. Oops. 2000, M. Fleming 016.
Eddie, I don't think you were able to get there this night.
No, I was out of town on business.
That's right. You were up north somewhere. So Carrie and I went, and this is Phyllis Cole and Johnny Carson. They are also the co-directors of the Atlanta Society of Entertainers, and we were honored to be selected for the year 2000 as the Bluegrass Band of the Year by the Atlanta Society of Entertainers in the Atlanta area, obviously. So that's our second big honor that we've gotten.
Okay, 2000, M. Fleming 036.
We got this logo just really fortunate. It served us well. But Eddie and I were both living in Peachtree City at the time, I believe. And we were playing the Peachtree City, the McIntosh Opry a lot. And one of our acquaintances over there, our little circle of friends, was a guy who was like the chief artist for the Baptist Association in Atlanta. Basically, they did all the Sunday school books and things for the Baptist Association. But he was a great artist, and he just kind of volunteered after we wheedled him a little bit to come up with us a logo. And he spent a lot of time and came up with about six different concepts on brush fire, and I'd go over and look at them, and this is the one that we all liked best. It was designed by Cowboy Jim Hurst, who lives in Peachtree City to this day, and we paid him well. I think we gave him about six albums with that on the covers. Was his pay for designing that logo.
Okay, at this point, one of the things that I would like to explore a little bit further would be how the brush fire sound actually came about and maybe evolved a little bit. So I don't know if y'all have a different perspective on that or if you've even thought about this before. But
I think we both agree that it wasn't anything really conscious about it. We started out, you know, Joe and Eddie and I again, and remembering that they'd already been singing together and doing some stuff. But we were just very fortunate that, you know, we had three good, strong parts. We could all sing different parts, and we had to blend. We all came from the same geographic area, so we had the same pronunciations. And I think that was a big part of the original sound. And just fortunate that the three of us were able to sing the right parts and blend. We had that gift, I think.
And this is you're bringing up something here I want to explore just a little bit more, and this is, you say that you're from the same geographical location, so you think it would be easier to bring the enunciations and pronunciations and so on together than if you had been from different places in the South in particular, where maybe the two-syllable words out of one-syllable words and those types of things, that didn't interfere with what you were doing.
I've always, you know, just assumed that would be easier.
Yeah, I think it made a difference. I think it would have made a difference on how the sound came about had we, say, come from different parts of the country.
That as we're looking at this, when you were doing your recording, I know that you listened to yourselves on tape a lot before you ever went in to do the recording. Did you find that you were doing some things subconsciously that you weren't aware of, that you maybe modified a little bit as you went on, and you really started studying the sound to move on with it?
Go ahead and lie to him, Eddie.
Well, I don't know that we actually changed anything. I mean, we did look at a lot of things in the recordings, like how long you would hold out a word or something, and whether everybody cut off at the same time or started at the same time, and we found out that made a big difference in the blend. So we sort of worked on those little problems a lot to make it smoother.
Yeah, we talked about dynamics. You know, it's one thing to sing the same words and sing the right notes, but it's another whole thing to get the right dynamics, to get the right tones. You can really blend. You know, you can have three people singing the three right notes, and you can have three people singing the three right notes and blending, and you can get two different sounds. And I really think we were, to some extent, just were fortunate that I know Joe and Eddie are both, you know, were great harmony singers. They already had that before I came to them. We were just fortunate to have, you know, pretty good ears and a little talent between us. But we did work at it, too. There was never a conscious sound. We never tried to sound like anybody. But we knew when that harmony was right. Mm-hmm. And that's when it was good for us, was when that harmony was right.
Well, the reason I'm pursuing this is because I'm sure that you're aware of this, but maybe not as aware of it as a lot of your fans are, that the thing that a lot of people really like and they look forward to with brush fire are the harmonies. And so that's why I'm kind of exploring a little bit in the beginning as to how you kind of came about with this. But let's move on from there. And of course, with the instrumentals and all that kind of thing, and the instrumentation and the and so on, how did you see yourselves in the beginning, let's say, relating vocals to instrumentals?
Well, I think, first of all, we've always considered ourselves to be more vocal-oriented, especially in the the first, say, 10 or 12 years or maybe more, we figured out early on that the vocal parts were our strong point of the group. So we sort of worked that to our advantage. We focused more on our vocals more than the instrumentation. And in some ways, like we would find a key that the song sounded best vocally in, and we wouldn't focus so much on the instrumentation. We would make it work in that key as long as the vocals were right. Mm-hmm. Not saying we tried to make the instrumentation part of it suffer any, but the vocals were the first foremost priority. And once we got that right, then we'd do whatever we needed to do to the instrumentation.
Okay. Yeah, that was always our orientation. We didn't do instrumentals in the early years. We put one on that first album, and really just because we thought we ought to. Mm-hmm. We put together Arab Bounce, and then we just never did instrumentals. I was, none of us were great instrumentally at the time. Again, Joe and Eddie were far advanced from me. I was, I was playing a $99 blonde con guitar factory second. I didn't even have a case, and I'm not sure I had a capo, but I must have. When I first went out and met with them, I had two chords down and I was working on the third one, so I really couldn't carry, much instrumentally for quite a while. And we all improved over the years, but they were far, far advanced from me. And we just knew, even had we been, we knew where our strengths were, as Eddie said, and what we enjoyed,
And that's something that you carried through all the different organizations of Brush Fire as well, combinations, I should say, is that that seems to have been the strength, and that's the thing that the audience, when they see Brush Fire, is really there to hear. As good an instrumentalist as Eddie has grown into being, and certainly with Kerry, but still the highlight is the four-part harmony and the strong vocals.
Yeah, and I'm not sure we capitalize on that as much as we should at this point. But, there really have been four periods, I think, in Brush Fire. There was the early period when we were forming and hunting, and we had Mike Head on bass, and we had John Landers on bass, and we had Gary Sykes on bass. And that was kind of the early period. And we were looking, we had a good trio sound. We didn't really ever have a strong bass singer and didn't really have a strong bass player. Mike Head was pretty good, but he didn't stay. And that was the formative years. Then when Suggins came on, he had that gospel and that strong bass voice and that humor orientation going for him. And we had the smarts to say, hey, we can use this, and we did, and we made some great advancement in the Suggins years. He moved on, and we replaced him with Jay Richardson. Actually, Joe moved to the bass. Joe was so great and recognized that he was not the banjo player that Jay was, and was more than willing to switch over and take up the bass. And Joe had never really been a bass player, but for the band, he did that. And Jay came on, and Jay was the best banjo player we'd had, and also the best bass, the other fourth vocalist. He could sing baritone or bass. And he I think took us to another level, because we were able to improve on the instruments and the vocals. And we were doing, we'd been doing some acapella, we'd been doing some quartets, but the blend was so much better when Jay came in. So that was a period where I think we really made some advancement.
And in talking about Joe moving to the bass, Joe was always the kind of person that he always strived to get the very best out of the band possible. And there's a lot of people that would never make that sacrifice to say, okay, I'm going to give up playing the lead instrument in the group and go playing the bass because I think it's going to be better for the band and it's going to create a better sound. But that's the kind of person Joe was. And he would do whatever had to be done for the benefit of the band as a team, as a group.
That was, in fact, it was his idea, I think. He probably said, let's go after Jay. Jay had left Southern Crescent and moved down south of here, but he was too far to play with them and wasn't playing with anybody. And Joe could see that was going to be a great fit. So we did that. And then, of course, the fourth period was when after Jay left and Kerry joined the group. And, what can you say about Kerry's playing? I mean, he's just astronomical and phenomenal. And that brought us to a level. By this time, of course, Eddie's advanced on the mandolin, and we've got Joe really wasn't able to play much after Kerry joined the group, and Red joined on the bass, and he's just an outstanding bass player. So all of a sudden, for the first time, we can do, you know, instrumental songs as just about as well as anybody. You know, rhythm guitar's a little weak, but he just backs off and lets the rest of these guys have it. And I guess at that point, we've gotten more, we do a lot more instrumentals than we ever have because we can. But the vocals will always be, I know for me and Eddie anyway, the vocals will always be the our first love.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. All right, now the next thing I guess that I would like to explore is that I know that that you guys have had a lot of highlights in the 23, soon be 24 years that Brush Fire has been going. So what about sharing some of those that, each of you personally feel would be highlights?
Personal highlights. I guess one of the earliest highlights was probably for me was our first album,
1981,
I think.
Yeah,
or
80
or
81, something
I
like that.
I think it was 81. Our very first album, I mean, growing up and for me and playing gospel music a lot of my life, and I never thought I'd ever see the day that I'd get a chance to record a record album, so that was definitely a good highlight early on for me.
It was. We've talked a lot of times before Joe died and then after he died about, you know, when we started this thing, what our expectations were. And I don't think any of us ever thought that we'd be able to have the opportunity to do some of the things that we did. And yeah, going in the studio and doing that first album, Jasmine sound in you was great. Probably for me, one of the great things was the night that, you know, we had the opportunity to just stand on stage with Bill Monroe. I guess we sang, we hummed and we oohed a lot, but the good thing was we got that recognition, and that really meant a lot to us because there's a lot of people out there in this business a long time who have never had that opportunity.
And where was this now?
That was at the Kissimmee Bluegrass Festival, rodeo grounds in Kissimmee, St. Cloud, Florida. That was, I guess, the first time we had traveled out of state to play. Well, I know we've been to the edge of Alabama, but that was the first big festival with really big names that we'd gotten on. Eddie had just bought a new van, and it wasn't even finished on the inside. It was just rough, and we sat a bunch of lawn chairs in the back of it, drove 14 hours or something down the Florida Turnpike, made it big.
What year was that?
I don't know. What year did we decide that was? Probably 86.
Okay.
Around 86, right after, not too long after Jay started with the group.
Okay.
But Johnson Mountain Boys were on that festival. Lewis Family was on it. Big names, and we had arrived.
Okay. I guess another highlight for me was not too long after that, 1990, July,
Biggie.
August of 1990 was. We got a chance to go to the Pyrenees Folklore Festival in France and represent our country as performing traditional forms of music that originated within America. And had anyone ever told me I'd ever, through my music, be able to go outside to another country and play bluegrass music, I would have just laughed your head off. It was definitely a highlight in my life.
That was something. We got a phone call. I was at the music store, the original Jackson Music here in Newman one morning, just hanging out like I did on Saturday morning, and the phone rang. And it was a girl with a special edition Clarkers, and I knew her husband, and she immediately started saying, y'all want to go to France with us? We're going to France next summer, and we need y'all to go. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, you know, these pipe dreams come down the line, and... And I didn't want to cut her off, so I listened and we talked, and I'm still thinking pipe dream. And the more she talked, it sounded like, you know, might really work. And we actually put that thing together. And that's another thing that, you know, boy, yeah, like Eddie said, we never dreamed that we'd get out of the state of Georgia, much less out of the country, and onto a new beach in France. We had a guy with us who grew up not far from here, one of the dancers, and I just want to share this story. What was his name? Martin Gibbs. Milton. Milton Gibbs was with us. And Milton Gibbs was about 28, 30 years old and had never been out of the state of Georgia in his life except across the line into North Carolina a couple of months before with this dance troupe. And we set him on a plane and flew him across the ocean and set him down on a new beach in France. It's my turn, I think, to talk about some of the great things. And back in the about 85, we were founding members of the International Bluegrass Music Association, and have attended. Some of us have. We've been members of that organization since day one. We went to the very first trade show that they did. We played on the Fan Fest a couple of years in the early years. And actually been on the showcase there a couple of times, and I think that's pretty good achievement for four kids from Newnan, Georgia.
Okay. Well, another highlight I think was being inducted into the Atlanta Country Music Hall of Honor. That was certainly a good area recognition for a group. I mean, we've been playing music for a long time, I guess maybe 18, 20 years at that time, close to it, and it was really wonderful to be recognized in our area for the achievements that we had done through bluegrass music for so many years.
Okay. And let me add one more, and this kind of gets, we don't talk about it a lot, but Wayne Daniels' book, Picking on Peachtree Street. Wayne was nice enough through having met us at some festivals and done some interviews and things to include us in the final chapter of current country bluegrass music in Atlanta, and featured a little paragraph about Brushfire in his book, Picking on Peachtree, and that's something that'll always be there.
And you also received an honor within this last year, year 2000. So what about, tell us a little about that?
Well, that's the Atlanta Society of Entertainers, which has been formed in Atlanta for a lot of years. And they give out a lot of awards each year, but in 2000 we were selected as the Bluegrass Band of the Year and given a plaque at their annual dinner and reception in Atlanta. So, again, that's Johnny Carson and Phyllis Cole, the co-directors. Johnny Carson is the grandson of Fiddlin' John Carson and has really been a good friend to us. Just I looked him up when I was looking for Fiddlin' John's gravesite. And Johnny and I just kind of hooked up, and we've been good friends, and he's been good to us ever since.
Okay. All right. Any other particular highlights that you can think of?
Well, you know, there's been so many things that we've done. All four of the recording projects, each I think better than the last, and all the trips to Nashville that we made, and all the IBMA trade shows. Been on the same stage with, I guess, everybody who's anybody in bluegrass music in the time we've had this group. We've been on a festival bill with them somewhere at some time.
Tell me about your trip to Nashville and the Carl Tipton show.
Yeah, Eddie, cover that one.
Oh, wow.
Don't ask me. Yeah, that was during the Suggins years, so in the early 80s sometime.
Yeah, it was kind of a real early morning TV show, kind of a variety, mostly centered around music, but not necessarily totally bluegrass per se, old time music and I think some things. And we had a chance to go up and do the show, and we take, I think, a whole week's worth of tapings at one sitting in
one
afternoon.
Maybe it was a morning out.
And we sort of had to keep track of the day we were on, you know, each time we stepped up to play. It was quite an experience.
It was. And Leroy Troy, a young, very young Leroy Troy, was on that program with us. And we were special guests on the Carl Tipton show every morning for a week. And I've got a little video that somebody made of that. It's not very good, but I wouldn't take anything for it.
All right, so there have been a lot of highlights there, and I know you guys have been on the road traveling here for 23 years, I guess, for this now, as we're talking about. And I know there have been some humorous types of incidences that have taken place, so kind of share some of those with us.
Two come to mind in the early years. Joe was a chewer. And I'll never forget the night he turned his spit cup over in the back of the van on top of the sound equipment. So we kind of broke him up of that. And so what he did the next time was he pitched it out the window of Eddie's van and left a brown streak down the whole side of the van. But he didn't turn it over in the van. And cleaning up Joe's tobacco was one of the early highlights.
It took me the next day to find that. And by that time, it had dried real good and hard. It wasn't near as much as fun then. It wasn't near as funny then.
Well, I thought it was. And then, of course, there was...
Yeah. Wasn't your van.
That's true. Pulling through the drive-in window at the liquor store with a trailer we just bought from a gospel group with scriptures all over it was another one of the highlights. And that wasn't... Doing it wasn't so bad. It was being told later how many people saw us pulling through the liquor store drive-in with scriptures on the trailer. And still people from down in Florida remind me about that. Eddie went on stage at Marietta with his pants unzipped. That's one of the biggies.
And no one has ever let me forget it.
Or will they?
I doubt it.
A couple of more recent things stick in my way. Well, one particularly in my mind in a hotel room somewhere. I don't have any idea where we were. Red was fooling with the TV, and I'm laying back on the bed, and the remote control for the TV is bolted to the table between the two beds. So Red gets down in front of the TV and turns it on and flips through the channels and finds the channel that he wanted. And I'm just sitting there with my finger on the remote, and he'd find what he wanted, and he'd get up and sit on the end of the bed, and I'd change the channel. He'd cuss the TV, blank, get back down there, fine-tune it. Get it back on the channel he wanted it, and this time I'd let him get back on the bed and get comfortable. I'd hit the remote, turn it off. He'd get back in the floor. He cussed that TV for 15 minutes before he realized I had the remote. I thought that was hilarious.
Well, yeah. You've been talking about the convict.
Oh, yes, Carol Haney and the escaped convict. That's a little bit of a long story, but if you got time.
Oh, yeah, we got time.
We were playing at the Marietta Bluegrass Festival out on Callaway Road, and Carol Haney had been playing fiddle for us some prior to this festival, and I was sitting in the motorhome with Carol and Max, a friend of Carol's, and it was Max's motorhome. And suddenly there was a knock on the door, and Max went to the door, and standing there was this guy in his early 20s, and he was soaking wet, but he was totally naked except for he had a towel wrapped around him. And he commenced to telling Max and Carol some story about he was there with a bunch of college students, and as a college initiation, they had taken all of his clothes off, throwed him in the lake. He'd swim down the lake, and he had crawled out and got someone to hand him a towel, and he, as part of the initiation, he had to get back up to the end of the lake to rejoin his group. So they went back, gave him a shirt and a pair of pants to put on, and even gave him a beer to drink while he was sitting in there, sitting around, and he was a nice, clean-cut guy. And after a few minutes, he said, I'll be back in about 10 minutes with your clothes. I just need to get back to my campsite up here. Nobody thought anything about it. A little while later, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes later, we were all back up at the upper part of the festival ground, and a lot of commotion was going on with law enforcement over there. As it turns out, they had apprehended this guy. It turned out he was an escaped convict who had escaped from some prison facilities just not far on the other side of the fairground there. Took off his prison clothes, jumped in the lake and swam across the lake and concocted this story about a college initiation. Carol had gone up to the police to see what was going on since he'd seen this guy, you know, just a few minutes ago in the motorhome. Then they started questioning Carol about aiding an escaped convict, unknowing to him anything about it, and it just really got all twisted around. It was, you'd just had to have been there.
Thinking about one of the funniest things, or kind of embarrassing, I guess, at a festival. We were, in the early years, we were a festival with Jay and Lonely Baxter, and we had worked up a song. I don't remember what it was. Of course, we had a limited repertoire, and they knew everything that had ever been recorded or written. So I'm listening to them, and they're doing a song that we got on our program. I told Jay, and I asked him, I said, y'all doing that song tonight? And he said, yeah, we thought we'd do it. And I said, well, okay, we were going to do it too. And he said, well, y'all go ahead and do it because we know another one. Thanks, JR. You know, I'm far from wrong. We did it worse than they did. But
typical Jay and Baxter understatement.
That's right. Go ahead and do it. We know another one. I want to share this one more story that I thought of earlier. We were playing a Veterans Day celebration down at Burnt Village Campground in the early years. Joe was playing the banjo, and they had brought in, being Veterans Day, a brass band from the Air Corps or something like that, a bunch of military guys. And just one black guy named Calvin Baker, and somewhere I've got a picture in all of my pictures of Calvin Baker, nicest guy in the world. And somewhere along the way, he had learned a little rudimentary banjo. And he came up, and we were talking to him during the break, and you know, got to be pretty good friends, and Joe was showing him his banjo. And the break was over, and we went back up on stage and did two or three songs, and I saw Calvin out there. So I said, well, we're going to do our next song for a new friend we met, a banjo player, Calvin Baker. And I looked down at my guitar, and the next song was I Wear a White Robe. So we went ahead and did it. Fortunately, Calvin had a sense of humor. And we went ahead, I guess the polite thing would have been to substitute, but somehow.
Okay, and one of the things now I would like for y'all to do, kind of as a personal favor to me, is a little bit of a cappella stuff. I know that there's a lot of songs that y'all do with 3- and 4-part harmony, and I feel that you could probably do just as well with 2-part harmony. So.
Well, that's a bizarre request, and up to now it's been free, but this will cost you. I don't think we've ever done anything like this.
Two-part
acapella. Well, what the heck? I believe that's an A.
Satan has parted fathers and mothers, filling their hearts with his envy and hate, heading their pathways down to destruction, leaving their children like orphans to stray. The family who prayed will never be parted. Their circle in heaven unbroken shall stand. God will say, enter, thy good faithful servant. And the family who prayed never shall part.
We've probably done that better, but
that's great. Okay, now I think we're ready for Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Song we ever learned as a group.
So that was the all I ever.
All right.
All I ever loved was you. You brought
If you do, you'll never find a love so true. For all I ever loved was you. All I ever loved was you. You broke a heart that cried for you. I've wasted all my tears on you. For all I ever loved was you. For all I ever loved was you.
Okay, great.
At this point, 23 years. It's been a great 23 years. We're certainly not about to quit, not about to shut it down. I don't think anybody's interested in doing that. We're not playing as much at this point as we have in the past, and probably won't ever go back to the point that we were at, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. At that point, if somebody wanted us to play, we dropped what we were doing and pretty much abandoned most anything else and went and did it, and we're just not in a position to do that. But I don't see the group doing anything but continuing to play with the four members we've got for quite a few years yet to come.
No.
Of course, that may be a phone call, you know, offered Eddie a better job.
It's all right.
Okay, so Eddie, your feelings?
Well, you know, I don't think we're, like Mike said, I don't think we're ever going to quit. We may not go as far to do it as we used to do it. We may not do it as much as we used to do it, but I think we'll continue to do it. None of us has certainly given up our day jobs or anything like that. And, you know, I think our expectations of what we were trying to get out of it all these years were a little different maybe than some other people that wanted to go on to doing it for a living and things like that. I think we've reached a comfort zone with what we're doing. And right now we're still having fun at what we're doing. And I remember one thing that Joe always told me, and he said, when it quits being fun, I'm going to get out of it. So we're still trying to make it fun, and I think that's where we're at now today, and I think that's where we'll continue to be with it for as long as we are in it.
Fortunately, we are in a position where we can do that and play what we want to when we want to. I got a feeling that you know, somewhere way, way, way down the road, when if it ever finally does dissolve, that Eddie and I'll be standing on the street corner up here with a case open, you know, doing the Family Who Prayed, like the Lubin Brothers. But that's probably, you know, 30 years away from now, with walkers and wheelchairs, and
it'll still be fun.
if we're still doing it, it'll be because it's still fun.
That's good. Well, guys, I want to thank y'all for sitting down and giving me this information, and I certainly appreciate Mike and Sally extending the hospitality of their home here to me for these 2 or 3 days. It's been a great experience. And Eddie, I'd like to thank you for coming over and taking part in this, and both of you for the great jam session up at the music store this morning. And on behalf of a lot of the fans, 23 years of great music, and looking forward to a lot more to go.
Well, Bill, on behalf of the Bluegrass community, thank you for all the effort you put into chronicling what we've all tried to do.